making and selling it. Orders for this particular model had been going down for a good many years, but they shot up as former customers reordered against the day when the model would no longer be available. No one had, however, asked, who needs to know of this decision? Therefore, nobody informed the clerk in the purchasing department who was in charge of buying the parts from which the model itself was being assembled. His instructions were to buy parts in a given ratio to current sales, and the instructions remained unchanged. When the time came to discontinue further production of the model, the company had in its warehouse enough parts for another 8 to 10 years of production, parts that had to be written off at a considerable loss. The action must also be appropriate to the capacities of the people who have to carry it out. A chemical company found itself in recent years with fairly large amounts of blocked currency in two West African countries. It decided that to protect this money, it had to invest it locally in businesses which would contribute to the local economy, wouldn't require imports from abroad, and would, if successful, be the kind that could be sold to local investors if and when currency remittances became possible again. To establish these businesses, the company developed a simple chemical process to preserve a tropical fruit, which is a staple crop in both countries, and which up until then had suffered serious spoilage in transit to its western markets. The business was a success in both countries, but in one country, the local manager set the business up in such a manner that it required highly skilled and, above all, technically trained management of the kind not easily available in West Africa. In the other country, the local manager thought through the capacities of the people who would eventually have to run the business and worked hard at making both process and business simple and at staffing from the start with nationals of the country right up to the top. A few years later, it became possible again to transfer currency from these two countries, but though the business flourished, no buyer could be found for it in the first country. No one available locally had the necessary managerial and technical skills. The business had to be liquidated at a loss. In the other country, so many local entrepreneurs were eager to buy the business that the company repatriated its original investment with a substantial profit. The profit and the business built on it were essentially the same in both places. But in the first country, no one had asked, what kind of people do we have available to make this decision effective, and what can they do? As a result, the decision itself became frustrated. All this becomes doubly important when people have to change behavior, habits, or attitudes if a decision is to become effective action. Here one has to make sure not only that responsibility for the action is clearly assigned and that the people responsible are capable of doing the needful, one has to make sure that their measurements, their standards for accomplishment, and their incentives are changed simultaneously. Otherwise, the people will get caught in a paralyzing internal emotional conflict. Theodore Vail's decision that the business of the Bell System was service might have remained dead letter but for the yardsticks of service performance which he designed to measure managerial performance. Bell managers were used to being measured by the profitability of their units, or at the least by cost. The new yardsticks made them accept rapidly the new objectives. In sharp contrast is the recent failure of a brilliant chairman and chief executive to make effective a new organization structure and new objectives in an old, large, and proud American company. Everyone agreed that the changes were needed. The company, after many years as leader of its industry, showed definite signs of aging in almost all major fields. Newer, smaller, and more aggressive competitors were outflanking it. But to gain acceptance for the new ideas, the chairman promoted the most prominent spokesmen of the old school into the most visible and best-paid positions, especially into three new executive vice presidencies. This meant only one thing to the people in the company. They don't really mean it. If the greatest rewards are given for behavior contrary to that which the new course of action requires, then everyone will conclude that this contrary behavior is what the people at the top really want and are going to reward. Not everyone can do what Vail did and build the execution of his decisions into the decision itself, but everyone can think what action commitments a specific decision requires, what work assignments follow from it, and what people are available to carry it out. 5. Finally, a feedback has to be built into the decision to provide a continuous testing against actual events of the expectations that underlie the decision. Decisions are made by men. Men are fallible. At their best, their works don't last long. Even the best decision has a high probability of being wrong. Even the most effective one eventually becomes obsolete. If this needs documentation, the Vail and Sloan decisions supply it. Despite their imagination and daring, only one of Vail's decisions, the decision that service was the business of the Bell system, is still valid today and applicable in the form in which he worked it out. The investment character of the AT&T common share had to be drastically changed in the 1950s in response to the emergence of the institutional investors, pension trusts, and mutual funds, as the new channels through which the middle class invests. While Bell Labs has maintained its dominant position, the new scientific and technological developments, especially in space technology and in such devices as the laser, have made it reasonably clear that no communications company, no matter how large, can any longer hope to provide by its own means all its own technological and scientific needs. At the same time, the development of technology has made it probable, for the first time in 75 years, that new processes of telecommunications will seriously compete with the telephone, and that in major communications fields, for example, information and data communication, no single communications medium can maintain dominance, let alone the monopoly which Bell has had for oral communications over distance. And, while regulation remains a necessity for the existence of a privately owned telecommunications company, the regulation Bell worked so hard to make effective, that is, regulation by the individual states, is becoming increasingly inappropriate to the realities of a nationwide and indeed international system, but the inevitable and necessary regulation by the federal government hasn't been worked out by the Bell system and has instead been fought by it through the kind of delaying action Bell was so careful not to engage in. As to Sloan's decentralization of General Motors, it still stands, but it's becoming clear that it'll have to be thought through again soon. Not only have basic principles of his design been changed and revised so often that they've become fuzzy beyond recognition, the autonomous automotive decisions, for instance, increasingly are not in full control of their manufacturing and assembly operations, and therefore not fully responsible for the results. The individual makes of car, from Chevrolet to Cadillac, have also long ceased to represent major price classes the way Sloan originally designed them. Above all, Sloan designed a U.S. company, and though it soon acquired foreign subsidiaries, it remained a U.S. company in its organization and management structure. But General Motors is clearly an international company today. Its great growth and major opportunities are increasingly outside the United States, and especially in Europe. It'll survive and prosper only if it finds the right principles and the right organization for the multinational company. The job Sloan did in 1922 will have to be done over again soon. It'll predictably become pressing as soon as the industry runs into a period of economic difficulties, and if not done over fairly drastically, Sloan's solution is likely to become a millstone around GM's neck and increasingly a bar to its success. When General Eisenhower was elected president, his predecessor Harry S. Truman said, "Poor Ike. When he was a general, he gave an order and it was carried out. Now he is going to sit in that big office and he'll give an order and not a damn thing is going to happen." The reason why not a damn thing is going to happen is, however, not that generals have more authority than presidents. It's that military organizations learned long ago that futility is the lot of most orders and organized the feedback to check on the execution of the order. They learned long ago that to go oneself and look is the only reliable feedback. Reports, all a president is normally able to mobilize, aren't much help. All military services have long ago learned that the officer who has given an order goes out and sees for himself whether it has been carried out. At the least, he sends one of his own aides. He never relies on what he's told by the subordinate to whom the order was given. Not that he distrusts the subordinate. He's learned from experience to distrust communications. This is the reason why a battalion commander is expected to go out and taste the food served his men. He could, of course, read the menus and order this or that item to be brought in to him, but no. He's expected to go into the mess hall and take his sample of the food from the same kettle that serves the enlisted men. With the coming of the computer, this will become even more important, for the decision maker will in all likelihood be even further removed from the scene of action. Unless he accepts, as a matter of course, that he had better go out and look at the scene of action, he'll be increasingly divorced from reality. All a computer can handle are abstractions, and abstractions can be relied on only if they're constantly checked against the concrete. Otherwise, they're certain to mislead us. To go and look for oneself is also the best, if not the only, way to test whether the assumptions on which a decision has been made are still valid or whether they're becoming obsolete and need to be thought through again, and one always has to expect the assumptions to become obsolete sooner or later. Reality never stands still very long. Failure to go out and look is the typical reason for persisting in a course of action long after it has ceased to be appropriate or even rational. This is true for business decisions as well as for governmental policies. It explains in large measure the failure of Stalin's post-war policy in Europe, but also the inability of the United States to adjust its policies to the realities of de Gaulle's Europe, or the failure of the British to accept until too late the reality of the European common market. One needs organized information for the feedback. One needs reports and figures, but unless one builds one's feedback around direct exposure to reality, unless one disciplines oneself to go out and look, one condemns oneself to a sterile dogmatism and with it to ineffectiveness. These are the elements of the decision process. But what about the decision itself? Chapter 7. Effective Decisions. A decision is a judgment. It's a choice between alternatives. It's rarely a choice between right and wrong. It's at best a choice between almost right and probably wrong, but much more often a choice between two courses of action, neither of which is provably more nearly right than the other. Most books on decision-making tell the reader, first find the facts. But executives who make effective decisions know that one doesn't start with facts. One starts with opinions. These are, of course, nothing but untested hypotheses, and as such, worthless unless tested against reality. To determine what's a fact requires first a decision on the criteria of relevance, especially on the appropriate measurement. This is the hinge of the effective decision, and usually its most controversial aspect. Finally, the effective decision doesn't, as so many texts on decision-making proclaim, flow from a consensus on the facts. The understanding that underlies the right decision grows out of the clash and conflict of divergent opinions and out of the serious consideration of competing alternatives. To get the facts first is impossible. There are no facts unless one has a criterion of relevance. Events by themselves aren't facts. In physics, the taste of a substance isn't a fact, nor until fairly recently was its color. In cooking, the taste is a fact of supreme importance, and in painting, the color matters. Physics, cooking, and painting consider different things as relevant, and therefore consider different things to be facts. But the effective executive also knows that people don't start out with the search for facts. They start out with an opinion. There's nothing wrong with this. People experienced in an area should be expected to have an opinion. Not to have an opinion after having been exposed to an area for a good long time would argue an unobservant eye and a sluggish mind. People inevitably start out with an opinion. To ask them to search for the facts first is even undesirable. They'll simply do what everyone is far too prone to do anyhow. Look for the facts that fit the conclusion they've already reached, and no one has ever failed to find the facts he's looking for. The good statistician knows this and distrusts all figures. He either knows the fellow who found them, or he doesn't know him. In either case, he's suspicious. The only rigorous method, the only one that enables us to test an opinion against reality, is based on the clear recognition that opinions come first, and that this is the way it should be. Then no one can fail to see that we start out with untested hypotheses. In decision-making, as in science, the only starting point. We know what to do with hypotheses. One doesn't argue them, one tests them. One finds out which hypotheses are tenable, and therefore worthy of serious consideration, and which are eliminated by the first test against observable experience. The effective executive encourages opinions, but he insists that the people who voice them also think through what it is that the experiment, that is, the testing of the opinion against reality, would have to show. The effective executive therefore asks, what do we have to know to test the validity of this hypothesis? What would the facts have to be to make this opinion tenable? And he makes it a habit, in himself and in the people with whom he works, to think through and spell out what needs to be looked at, studied, and tested. He insists that people who voice an opinion also take responsibility for defining what factual findings can be expected and should be looked for. Perhaps the crucial question here is, what is the criterion of relevance? This more often than not turns on the measurement appropriate to the matter under discussion and to the decision to be reached. Whenever one analyzes the way a truly effective, a truly right decision has been reached, one finds that a great deal of work and thought went into finding the appropriate measurement. This, of course, is what made Theodore Vail's conclusion that service was the business of the Bell system such an effective decision. the effective decision maker assumes that the traditional measurement isn't the right measurement. Otherwise, there would generally be no need for a decision. A simple adjustment would do. The traditional measurement reflects yesterday's decision. That there's need for a new one normally indicates that the measurement is no longer relevant. That the procurement and inventory policies of the U.S. Armed Services were in bad shape had been known ever since the Korean War. There have been countless studies, but things got worse rather than better. When Robert McNamara was appointed Secretary of Defense by President Kennedy, however, he challenged the traditional measurements of military inventory, measurements in total dollars and in total numbers of items in procurement and inventory. Instead, Mr. McNamara identified and separated the very few items, maybe 4% of the items by number, which together account for 90% or more of the total procurement dollars. He similarly identified the very few items, perhaps again 4%, which account for 90% of combat readiness. Since some items belong in both categories, the list of crucial items came to 5 or 6% of the total, whether measured by number or by dollars. Each of these, McNamara insisted, had to be managed separately and with attention to minute detail. The rest, the 95% or so of all items which account neither for the bulk of the dollars nor for essential combat readiness, he changed to management by exception, that is, to management by probability and averages. The new measurement immediately made possible highly effective decisions on procurement and inventory keeping and on logistics. The best way to find the appropriate measurement is again to go out and look for the feedback discussed earlier, only this is feedback before the decision. In most personnel matters, for instance, events are measured in averages, such as the average number of lost time accidents per 100 employees, the average percentage of absenteeism in the whole workforce, or the average illness rate per 100. But the executive who goes out and looks for himself will soon find that he needs a different measurement. The averages serve the purposes of the insurance company, but they are meaningless, indeed misleading, for personnel management decisions. The great majority of all accidents occur in one or two places in the plant. The great bulk of absenteeism is in one department. Even illness resulting in absence from work, we now know, isn't distributed as an average, but is concentrated in a very small part of the workforce, e.g. young unmarried women. The personnel actions to which dependence on the averages will lead, for instance, the typical plant-wide safety campaign, won't produce the desired results, may indeed make things worse. Similarly, failure to go and look was a major factor in the failure of the automobile industry to realize in time the need for safety engineering of the car. The automobile companies measured only by the conventional averages of number of accidents per passenger mile or per car. Had they gone out and looked, they would have seen the need to measure also the severity of bodily injuries resulting from accidents, and this would soon have highlighted the need to supplement their safety campaigns by measures aimed at making the accident less dangerous, that is, by automotive design. Finding the appropriate measurement is thus not a mathematical exercise, it's a risk-taking judgment. Whenever one has to judge, one must have alternatives among which one can choose. A judgment in which one can only say yes or no is no judgment at all. Only if there are alternatives can one hope to get insight into what is truly at stake. Effective executives therefore insist on alternatives of measurement so that they can choose the one appropriate one. There are a number of measurements for a proposal on a capital investment. One of these focuses on the length of time it will take before the original investment has been earned back. Another one focuses on the rate of profitability expected from the investment. A third one focuses on the present value of the returns expected to result from the investment, and so on. The effective executive won't be content with any one of these conventional yardsticks, no matter how fervently his accounting department assures him that only one of them is scientific. He knows, if only from experience, that each of these analyses brings out a different aspect of the same capital investment decision. Until he's looked at each possible dimension of the decision, he can't really know which of these ways of analyzing and measuring is appropriate to the specific capital decision before him. Much as it annoys the accountants, the effective executive will insist on having the same investment decision calculated in all three ways, so as to be able to say at the end, "This measurement is appropriate to this decision." Unless one has considered alternatives, one has a closed mind. This above all explains why effective decision makers deliberately disregard the second major command of the textbooks on decision making and create dissension and disagreement rather than consensus. Decisions of the kind the executive has to make aren't made well by acclamation. They're made well only if based on the clash of conflicting views, the dialogue between different points of view, the choice between different judgments. The first rule in decision-making is that one doesn't make a decision unless there's disagreement. Alfred P. Sloan is reported to have said at a meeting of one of his top committees, "Gentlemen, I take it we are all in complete agreement on the decision here." Everyone around the table nodded assent. "Then," continued Mr. Sloan, "I propose we postpone further discussion of this matter until our next meeting to give ourselves time to develop disagreement and perhaps gain some understanding of what the decision is all about." Sloan was anything but an intuitive decision maker. He always emphasized the need to test opinions against facts and the need to make absolutely sure that one didn't start out with the conclusion and then look for the facts that would support it. But he knew that the right decision demands adequate disagreement. Every one of the effective presidents in American history has his own method of procuring the disagreement he needed in order to make an effective decision. Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Harry Truman, each had his own ways, but each created the disagreement he needed for some understanding of what the decision is all about. Washington, we know, hated conflicts and quarrels and wanted a united cabinet, yet he made quite sure of the necessary differences of opinion on important matters by asking both Hamilton and Jefferson for their opinions. The president who understood best the need for organized disagreement was probably Franklin D. Roosevelt. Whenever anything of importance came up, he would take aside one of his aides and say to him, "I want you to work on this for me, but keep it a secret." This made sure, as Roosevelt knew perfectly well, that everybody in Washington heard about it immediately. Then Roosevelt would take aside a few other men, known to differ from the first, and would give them the same assignment, again, in the strictest confidence. As a result, he could be reasonably certain that all important aspects of every matter were being thought through and presented to him. He could be certain that he wouldn't become the prisoner of somebody's preconceived conclusions. This practice was severely criticized as execrable administration by the one so-called professional manager in Roosevelt's cabinet, his Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ikes, whose diaries are full of diatribes against the president's sloppiness, indiscretions, and treachery. But Roosevelt knew that the main task of an American president isn't administration, it's the making of policy, the making of the right decisions, and these are made best on the basis of adversary proceedings, to use the term of the lawyers for their method of getting at the true facts in a dispute, and of making sure that all relevant aspects of a case are presented to the court. There are three main reasons for the insistence on disagreement. It is first the only safeguard against the decision makers becoming the prisoner of the organization. Everybody always wants something from the decision maker. Everybody's a special pleader, trying, often in perfectly good faith, to obtain the decision he favors. This is true whether the decision maker is the President of the United States or the most junior engineer working on a design modification. The only way to break out of the prison of special pleading and preconceived notions is to make sure of argued, documented, thought-through disagreements. Second, disagreement alone can provide alternatives to a decision, and a decision without an alternative is a desperate gambler's throw, no matter how carefully thought through it might be. There's always a high possibility that the decision will prove wrong, either because it was wrong to begin with or because a change in circumstances makes it wrong. If one has thought through alternatives during the decision-making process, one has something to fall back on, something that's already been thought through, that's been studied, that's understood. Without such an alternative, one's likely to flounder dismally when reality proves a decision to be inoperative. In the last chapter, I referred to both the Schlieffen Plan of the German Army in 1914 and President Franklin D. Roosevelt's original economic program. Both were disproven by events at the very moment when they should have taken effect. The German army never recovered. It never formulated another strategic concept. It went from one ill-conceived improvisation to the next. But this was inevitable. For 25 years, no alternatives to the Schlieffen Plan had been considered by the general staff. All its skills had gone into working out the details of this master plan. When the plan fell to pieces, no one had an alternative to fall back on. Despite all their careful training in strategic planning, The generals could only improvise, that is, dash off first in one direction and then in another, without any real understanding why they dashed off in the first place. Another 1914 event also shows the danger of having no alternative. After the Russians had ordered mobilization, the Tsar had second thoughts. He called in his chief of staff and asked him to halt the mobilization. "Your Majesty," the general answered, "this is impossible. There is no plan for calling off the mobilization once it is started." I do not believe that World War I would necessarily have been averted had the Russians been able to stop their military machine at the last moment, but there would have been one last chance for sanity. By contrast, President Roosevelt, who in the months before he took office had based his whole campaign on the slogan of economic orthodoxy, had a team of able people, the later Brains Trust, working on an alternative, a radical policy based on the proposals of the old-time progressives and aimed at economic and social reform on a grand scale. When the collapse of the banking system made it clear that economic orthodoxy had become political suicide, Roosevelt had his alternative ready. He therefore had a policy. Yet without a prepared alternative, Roosevelt was as totally lost as the German General Staff or the Tsar of the Russians. When he assumed the presidency, Roosevelt was committed to conventional 19th century theory for the international economy. Between his election in November 1932, however, and his taking office the following March, the bottom fell out of the international economy just as much as it had fallen out of the domestic economy. Roosevelt clearly saw this, but without alternatives, he was reduced to impotent improvisation, and even as able and agile a man as President Roosevelt could only grope around in what suddenly had become total fog, could only swing wildly from one extreme to another, as he did when he torpedoed the London Economic Conference, could only become the prisoner of the economic snake oil salesmen with their patent nostrums such as dollar devaluation or the remonetization of silver, both totally irrelevant to any of the real problems. An even clearer example was Roosevelt's plan to pack the Supreme Court after his landslide victory in 1936. When this plan ran into strong opposition in a Congress which he thought he controlled completely, Roosevelt had no alternative. As a result, he not only lost his plan for court reform, he lost control of domestic politics, despite his towering popularity and his massive majorities. Above all, disagreement is needed to stimulate the imagination. One doesn't, to be sure, need imagination to find the right solution to a problem, but then this is a value only in mathematics. In all matters of true uncertainty, such as the executive deals with, whether his sphere is political, economic, social, or military, one needs creative solutions which create a new situation, and this means that one needs imagination, a new and different way of perceiving and understanding. Imagination of the first order is, I admit, not in abundant supply, but neither is it as scarce as is commonly believed. Imagination needs to be challenged and stimulated, however, or else it remains latent and unused. Disagreement, especially if forced to be reasoned, thought through, documented, is the most effective stimulus we know. Few people have Humpty Dumpty's ability to imagine a great many impossible things before breakfast, and still fewer have the imagination of Humpty Dumpty's creator, Lewis Carroll, the author of Alice in Wonderland, but even very small children have the imagination to enjoy Alice. And as Jerome S. Bruner points out, even an 8-year-old sees in a flash that while 4 times 6 equals 6 times 4, a blind Venetian isn't the same thing as a Venetian blind. This is imaginative sight of a high order. Far too many adult decisions are made on the assumption that a blind Venetian must indeed be the same as a Venetian blind. An old story tells of a South Sea Islander of Victorian times who, after his return from a visit to the West, told his fellow islanders that the Westerners had no water in their houses and buildings. On his native island, water flowed through hollowed logs and was clearly visible. In the Western city, it was conducted in pipes, and therefore flowed only when someone turned a tap, but no one had explained the tap to the visitor. Whenever I hear this story, I think of imagination. Unless we turn the tap, imagination won't flow. The tap is argued, disciplined disagreement. The effective decision-maker, therefore, organizes disagreement. This protects him against being taken in by the plausible, but false or incomplete. It gives him the alternatives so that he can choose and make a decision, but also so that he's not lost in the fog when his decision proves deficient or wrong in execution, and it forces the imagination, his own and that of his associates. Disagreement converts the plausible into the right, and the right into the good decision. The effective decision maker doesn't start out with the assumption that one proposed course of action is right and that all others must be wrong. Nor does he start out with the assumption, I am right and he is wrong. He starts out with the commitment to find out why people disagree. Effective executives know, of course, that there are fools around and that there are mischief makers, but they don't assume that the man who disagrees with what they themselves see as clear and obvious is therefore either a fool or a knave. They know that unless proven otherwise, the dissenter has to be assumed to be reasonably intelligent and reasonably fair-minded. Therefore, it has to be assumed that he has reached his so obviously wrong conclusion because he sees a different reality and is concerned with a different problem. The effective executive, therefore, always asks, what does this fellow have to see if his position were, after all, tenable, rational, intelligent? The effective executive is concerned first with understanding. Only then does he even think about who is right and who is wrong. In a good law office, the beginner, fresh out of law school, is first assigned to drafting the strongest possible case for the other lawyer's client. This is not only the intelligent thing to do before one sits down to work out the case for one's own client. One has to assume, after all, that the opposition's lawyer knows his business too. It's also the right training for a young lawyer. It trains him not to start out with, I know why my case is right, but with thinking through what it is that the other side must know, see, or take as probable to believe that it has a case at all. It tells him to see the two cases as alternatives, and only then is he likely to understand what his own case is all about. Only then can he make out a strong case in court that his alternative is to be preferred over that of the other side. Needless to say, this isn't done by a great many people, whether executives or not. Most people start out with the certainty that what they see is the only way to see it all. The American steel executives have never missed the question, why do these union people get so terribly exercised every time we mention the word feather bedding? The union people, in turn, have never asked themselves why steel managements make such a fuss over feather bedding when every single instance thereof they have ever produced has proved to be petty and irrelevant to boot. Instead, both sides have worked mightily to prove each other wrong. If either side has tried to understand what the other one sees and why both would be a great deal stronger and labor relations in the steel industry, if not in U.S. industry, would be a good deal better and healthier. No matter how high his emotions run, no matter how certain he is that the other side is completely wrong and has no case at all, the executive who wants to make the right decision forces himself to see opposition as his means to think through the alternatives. He uses conflict of opinion as his tool to make sure all major aspects of an important matter are looked at carefully. There is one final question the effective decision maker asks. Is a decision really necessary? One alternative is always the alternative of doing nothing. Every decision is like surgery. It's an intervention into a system and therefore carries with it the risk of shock. One doesn't make unnecessary decisions any more than a good surgeon does unnecessary surgery. Individual decision makers like individual surgeons differ in their styles. Some are more radical or more conservative than others, but by and large, they agree on the rules. One has to make a decision when a condition is likely to degenerate if nothing is done. This also applies with respect to opportunity. If the opportunity is important and is likely to vanish unless one acts with dispatch, one acts and one makes a radical change. Theodore Vail's contemporaries agreed with him as to the degenerative danger of government ownership, but they wanted to fight it by fighting symptoms, fighting this or that bill in the legislature, opposing this or that candidate and supporting another, and so on. Vail alone understood that this is the ineffectual way to fight a degenerative condition. Even if one wins every battle, one can never win the war. He saw that drastic action was needed to create a new situation. He alone saw that private business had to make public regulation into an effective alternative to nationalization. At the opposite end, there are those conditions in respect to which one can, without being unduly optimistic, expect that they'll take care of themselves even if nothing's done. If the answer to the question, what will happen if we do nothing, is it will take care of itself, one doesn't interfere. Nor does one interfere if the condition, while annoying, is of no importance and unlikely to make any difference anyhow. It's a rare executive who understands this. The controller who in a desperate financial crisis preaches cost reduction is seldom capable of leaving alone minor blemishes, elimination of which will achieve nothing. He may know, for instance, that the significant costs that are out of control are in the sales organization and in physical distribution, and he'll work hard and brilliantly at getting them under control, but then he'll discredit himself and the whole effort by making a big fuss about the unnecessary employment of two or three old employees in an otherwise efficient and well-run plant, and he'll dismiss as immoral the argument that eliminating these few semi-pensioners won't make any difference anyhow. Other people are making sacrifices, he'll argue. Why should the plant people get away with inefficiency? When it's all over, the organization will forget fast that he saved the business. They'll remember, though, his vendetta against the two or three poor devils in the plant, and rightly so. De minimis non curat praeter. The magistrate does not consider trifles, said the Roman law almost 2,000 years ago. But many decision makers still need to learn it. The great majority of decisions will lie between these extremes. The problem isn't going to take care of itself, but it's unlikely to turn into degenerative malignancy either. The opportunity is only for improvement rather than for real change and innovation, but it's still quite considerable. If we don't act, in other words, we'll in all probability survive, but if we do act, we may be better off. In this situation, the effective decision maker compares effort and risk of action to risk of inaction. There's no formula for the right decision here, but the guidelines are so clear that decision in the concrete case is rarely difficult. They are: act if on balance the benefits greatly outweigh cost and risk, and act or do not act, but do not hedge or compromise. The surgeon who only takes out half the tonsils or half the appendix risks as much infection or shock as if he did the whole job, and he hasn't cured the condition, has indeed made it worse. He either operates or he doesn't. Similarly, the effective decision maker either acts or he doesn't act. He doesn't take half action. This is the one thing that's always wrong, and the one sure way not to satisfy the minimum specifications, the minimum boundary conditions. The decision's now ready to be made. The specifications have been thought through, the alternatives explored, the risks and gains weighed. Everything's known. Indeed, it's always reasonably clear by now what course of action must be taken. At this point, the decision does indeed almost make itself. And it's at this point that most decisions are lost. It becomes suddenly quite obvious that the decision isn't going to be pleasant, isn't going to be popular, isn't going to be easy. It becomes clear that a decision requires courage as much as it requires judgment. There's no inherent reason why medicines should taste horrible, but effective ones usually do. Similarly, there's no inherent reason why decisions should be distasteful, but most effective ones are. One thing the effective executive won't do at this point, he won't give in to the cry, "Let's make another study." This is the coward's way, and all the coward achieves is to die 1,000 deaths where the brave man dies but one. When confronted with the demand for another study, the effective executive asks, "Is there any reason to believe that additional study will produce anything new? And is there reason to believe that the new is likely to be relevant?" And if the answer's no, as it usually is, the effective executive doesn't permit another study. He doesn't waste the time of good people to cover up his own indecision. But at the same time, he won't rush into a decision unless he's sure he understands it. Like any reasonably experienced adult, he's learned to pay attention to what Socrates called his daemon, the inner voice, somewhere in the bowels that whispers, "Take care." Just because something is difficult, disagreeable, or frightening is no reason for not doing it if it isn't right. But one holds back, if only for a moment, if one finds oneself uneasy, perturbed, bothered without quite knowing why. "I always stop when things seem out of focus," is the way one of the best decision makers of my acquaintance puts it. 9 times out of 10, the uneasiness turns out to be over some silly detail, but the 10th time, one suddenly realizes that one has overlooked the most important fact in the problem, has made an elementary blunder, or is misjudged altogether. The 10th time one suddenly wakes up at night and realizes, as Sherlock Holmes did in the famous story, that the most significant thing is that the Hound of Baskerville didn't bark. But the effective decision-maker doesn't wait long. A few days, at the most a few weeks. If the daemon has not spoken by then, he acts with speed and energy, whether he likes to or not. Executives aren't paid for doing things they like to do, they're paid for getting the right things done. Most of all in their specific task, the making of effective decisions. Decision-making and the computer. Does all this still apply today when we have the computer? The computer, we're being told, will replace the decision-maker, at least in middle management. It'll make in a few years all the operating decisions, and fairly soon thereafter it'll take over the strategic decisions too. Actually, the computer will force executives to make, as true decisions, what are today mostly made as on-the-spot adaptations. It'll convert a great many people who traditionally have reacted, rather than acted, into genuine executives and decision-makers. The computer's a potent tool of the executive, like hammer or pliers, but unlike wheel or saw, it can't do anything man can't do, but it can do one human job, addition and subtraction, infinitely faster than man can do it, and being a tool that doesn't get bored, doesn't get tired, doesn't charge overtime. Like all tools that do better something man can do, the computer multiplies man's capacity. The other tools, such as the wheel, the airplane, or the television set that do something man can't do at all, add a new dimension to man, i.e., extend his nature. But like all tools, the computer can only do one or two things. It has narrow limitations, and it's the limitations of the computer that will force us to do as genuine decision what now is largely done as ad hoc adaptation. The strength of the computer lies in its being a logic machine. It does precisely what it's programmed to do. This makes it fast and precise. It also makes it a total moron, for logic is essentially stupid. It's doing the simple and obvious. The human being, by contrast, isn't logical. He's perceptual. This means that he's slow and sloppy, but he's also bright and has insight. The human being can adapt. That is, he can infer from scanty information or from no information at all what the total picture might be like. He can remember a great many things nobody has programmed. A simple and a common area where the typical traditional manager acts by way of on-the-spot adaptation is the commonplace inventory and shipping decision. The typical district sales manager knows, albeit most inaccurately, that customer A usually runs his plan on a tight schedule and would be in real trouble if a promised delivery didn't arrive on time. He knows also that customer B usually has adequate inventories of materials and supplies and can presumably manage to get by for a few days even if a delivery were late. He knows that customer C is already annoyed at his company and is only waiting for a pretext to shift his purchases to another supplier. He knows that he can get additional supplies of one item by asking for them as a special favor from this or that man in the plant back home, and so on. And on the basis of these experiences, the typical district sales manager adapts and adjusts as he goes along. The computer knows none of these things. At least it doesn't know them unless it's been specifically told that these are the facts that determine company policy toward consumer A or in respect to product B. All it can do is react the way it's been instructed and programmed. It no more makes decisions than the slide rule or the cash register. All it can do is compute. The moment a company tries to put inventory control on the computer, it realizes that it has to develop rules. It has to develop an inventory policy. As soon as it tackles this, it finds that the basic decisions in respect to inventory aren't inventory decisions at all. They're highly risky business decisions. Inventory emerges as a means of balancing different risks. The risk of disappointing customer expectations in respect to delivery and service. The risk and cost of turbulence and instability in manufacturing schedules. And the risk and cost of locking up money and merchandise which might spoil, become obsolete, or otherwise deteriorate. The traditional clichés don't greatly help. It is our aim to give 90% of our customers 90% fulfillment of delivery promises. Sounds precise. It's actually meaningless, as one finds out when one tries to convert it into the step-by-step moron logic of the computer. Does it mean that all our customers are expected to get 9 out of 10 orders when we promise them? Does it mean that our really good customers should get fulfillment all the time on all their orders, And how do we define a really good customer anyhow? Does it mean that we aim to give fulfillment of these promises on all our products? Or only on the major ones, which together account for the bulk of our production? And what policy, if any, do we have with respect to the many hundreds of products which are not major for us, though they might well be major for the customer who orders one of them? Each of these questions requires a risk-taking decision, and above all, a decision on principle. Until all these decisions have been made, the computer can't control inventory. They are decisions of uncertainty, and what's relevant to them couldn't even be defined clearly enough to be conveyed to the computer. To the extent, therefore, to which the computer, or any similar tool, is expected to keep operations on an even keel, or to carry out predetermined reactions to expected events, whether the appearance of hostile nuclear missiles on the far horizon, or the appearance of a crude oil with an unusual sulfur content in the petroleum refinery, the decision has to be anticipated and thought through. It can no longer be improvised. It can no longer be groped for in a series of small adaptations, each specific, each approximate, each, to use the physicist's terminology, a virtual rather than a real decision. It has to be a decision in principle. The computer is not the cause of this. The computer, being a tool, is probably not the cause of anything. It only brings out in sharp relief what has been happening all along. For this shift from the small adaptation to the decision in principle has been going on for a long time. It became particularly apparent during World War II and after in the military. Precisely because military operations became so large and interdependent, requiring, for instance, logistics systems embracing whole theaters of operations and all branches of the armed services, middle-level commanders increasingly had to know the framework of strategic decisions within which they were operating. They increasingly had to make real decisions rather than adapt their orders to local events. The second-level generals who emerged as the great men of World War II, a Rommel, a Bradley, a Zhukov, were all middle managers who thought through genuine decisions, rather than the dashing cavalry generals, the beaux sabreurs of earlier wars. As a result, decision-making can no longer be confined to the very small group at the top. In one way or another, almost every knowledge worker in an organization will either have to become a decision-maker himself, or will at least have to be able to play an active, an intelligent, and an autonomous part in the decision-making process. What in the past had been a highly specialized function, discharged by a small and usually clearly defined organ, with the rest adapting within a mold of custom and usage, is rapidly becoming a normal, if not an everyday task of every single unit in this new social institution, the large-scale knowledge organization. The ability to make effective decisions increasingly determines the ability of every knowledge worker, at least of those in responsible positions, to be effective altogether. A good example of the shift to decision which the new techniques impose on us is the much-discussed PERT, P-E-R-T, Program Evaluation and Review Technique, which aims at providing a roadmap for the critical tasks in a highly complex program, such as the development and construction of a new space vehicle. PERT aims at giving control of such a program by advanced planning of each part of the work, of its sequence, and of the deadlines each part has to meet for the whole program to be ready on time. This sharply curtails ad hoc adaptation. In its place, there are high-risk decisions. The first few times operating men have to work out a PERT schedule, they're invariably wrong in almost every one of their judgments. They're still trying to do through ad hoc adaptations what can only be done through systematic risk-taking decision-making. The computer has the same impact on strategic decisions. It can't make them, of course. All it can do, and even that is potential rather than actual so far, is to work through what conclusions follow from certain assumptions made regarding an uncertain future, or conversely, what assumptions underlie certain proposed courses of action. Again, all it can do is compute. For this reason, it demands clear analysis, especially of the boundary conditions the decision has to satisfy, and that requires risk-taking judgment of a high order. There are additional implications of the computer for decision-making. If properly used, for instance, it should free senior executives from much of the preoccupation with events inside the organization to which they're now being condemned by the absence or tardiness of reliable information. It should make it much easier for the executive to go and look for himself on the outside, that is, in the area where alone an organization can have results. The computer might also change one of the typical mistakes in decision-making. Traditionally, we've tended to err toward treating generic situations as a series of unique events. Traditionally, we've tended to doctor symptoms. The computer, however, can only handle generic situations. This is all logic is ever concerned with. Hence, we may well in the future tend to err by handling the exceptional, the unique, as if it were a symptom of the generic. This tendency underlies the complaints that we're trying to substitute the computer for the proven and tested judgment of the military man. This shouldn't be lightly dismissed as the grumbling of brass hats. The most cogent attack on the attempt to standardize military decisions was made by an outstanding civilian management scientist, Sir Solly Zuckerman, the eminent British biologist, who as scientific advisor to the British Ministry of Defense has played a leading part in the development of computer analysis and operations research. The greatest impact of the computer lies in its limitations, which will force us increasingly to make decisions, and above all, force middle managers to change from operators into executives and decision makers. This should have happened anyhow. One of the great strengths of such organizations as, for instance, General Motors among business firms or the German General Staff among military groups was precisely that these organizations long ago organized operating events as true decisions. The sooner operating managers learn to make decisions as genuine judgments on risk and uncertainty, the sooner we'll overcome one of the basic weaknesses of large organization, the absence of any training and testing for the decision-making top positions. As long as we can handle the events on the operating level by adaptation rather than by thinking, by feel rather than by knowledge and analysis, operating people, in government, in the military, or in business, will be untrained, untried, and untested when, as top executives, they're first confronted with strategic decisions. The computer will, of course, no more make decision makers out of clerks than the slide rule makes a mathematician out of a high school student. But the computer will force us to make an early distinction between the clerk and the potential decision maker, and it will permit the latter, may indeed force him, to learn purposeful, effective decision making. For unless someone does this, and does it well, the computer cannot compute. There is indeed ample reason why the appearance of the computer has sparked interest in decision making. But the reason isn't that the computer will take over the decision. The reason is that with the computers taking over computation, people all the way down the line in the organization will have to learn to be executives and to make effective decisions. Conclusion. Effectiveness must be learned. This audiobook rests on two premises. The executive's job is to be effective, and effectiveness can be learned. The executive is paid for being effective. He owes effectiveness to the organization for which he works. What then does the executive have to learn and have to do to deserve being an executive? In trying to answer this question, this audiobook has, on the whole, taken organizational performance and executive performance to be goals in and by themselves. Effectiveness can be learned is the second premise. The audiobook has therefore tried to present the various dimensions of executive performance in such sequence as to stimulate listeners to learn for themselves how to become effective executives. This is not a textbook, of course, if only because effectiveness, while capable of being learned, surely cannot be taught. Effectiveness is, after all, not a subject, but a self-discipline. But throughout this audiobook, and implicit in its structure and in the way it treats its subject matter, is always the question, what makes for effectiveness in an organization and in any of the major areas of an executive's day and work? Only rarely is the question asked, why should there be effectiveness? The goal of effectiveness is taken for granted. In looking back on the arguments and flow of these chapters and on their findings, another and quite different aspect of executive effectiveness emerges, however. Effectiveness reveals itself as crucial to a man's self-development, to organization development, and to the fulfillment and viability of modern society. 1. The first step toward effectiveness is a procedure, recording where the time goes. This is mechanical, if not mechanistic. The executive need not even do this himself. It's better done by a secretary or assistant, yet if this is all the executive ever does, he'll reap a substantial improvement. The result should be fast, if not immediate. If done with any continuity, recording one's time will also prod and nudge a man toward the next steps for greater effectiveness. The analysis of the executive's time, the elimination of the unnecessary time wasters, already requires some action. It requires some elementary decisions. It requires some changes in a man's behavior, his relationships, and his concerns. It raises searching questions regarding the relative importance of different uses of time, of different activities, and of their goals. It should affect the level and the quality of a good deal of work done. Yet this can perhaps still be done by going down a checklist every few months, that is, by following a form. It still concerns itself only with efficiency in the utilization of a scarce resource, namely time. 2. The next step, however, in which the executive is asked to focus his vision on contribution, advances from the procedural to the conceptual, from mechanics to analysis, and from efficiencies to concern with results. In this step, the executive disciplines himself to think through the reason why he's on the payroll and the contribution he ought to make. There's nothing very complicated about this. The questions the executive asks himself about his contribution are still straightforward and more or less schematic, but the answers to these questions should lead to high demands on himself, to thinking about his own goals and those of the organization, and to concern with values. They should lead to demands on himself for high standards. Above all, these questions ask the executive to assume responsibility rather than to act the subordinate, satisfied if he only pleases the boss. In focusing himself and his vision on contribution, the executive, in other words, has to think through purpose and ends rather than means alone. 3. Making strengths productive is fundamentally an attitude expressed in behavior. It's fundamentally respect for the person, one's own as well as others. It's a value system in action, but it's again learning through doing and self-development through practice. In making strengths productive, the executive integrates individual purpose and organization needs, individual capacity and organization results, individual achievement and organization opportunity. 4. Chapter 5, First Things First, serves as antiphon to the earlier chapter, Know Thy Time. These two chapters might be called the twin pillars between which executive effectiveness is suspended and on which it rests, but the procedure here no longer deals with a resource, time, but with the end product, the performance of organization and executive. What's being recorded and analyzed is no longer what happens to us, but what we should try to make happen in the environment around us, and what is being developed here is not information, but character, foresight, self-reliance, courage. What's being developed here, in other words, is leadership. Not the leadership of brilliance and genius, to be sure, but the much more modest yet more enduring leadership of dedication, determination, and serious purpose. 5. The effective decision, which the final chapters discuss, is concerned with rational action. There's no longer a broad and clearly marked path which the executive only has to walk down to gain effectiveness, but there are still clear surveyor's benchmarks to give orientation and guidance how to get from one to the next. How the executive, for instance, is to move from identifying a pattern of events as constituting a generic problem to the setting of the boundary conditions which the decision has to satisfy is not spelled out. This has to be done according to the specific situation encountered, but what needs to be done and in what sequence should be clear enough. In following these benchmarks, the executive, it is expected, will develop and train himself in responsible judgment. Effective decision-making requires both procedure and analysis, but its essence is an ethics of action. There's much more to the self-development of an executive than his training in effectiveness. He has to acquire knowledges and skills. He has to learn a good many new work habits as he proceeds along his career, and he'll occasionally have to unlearn some old work habits. But knowledges, skills, and habits, no matter how accomplished, will avail the executive little unless he first develops himself in effectiveness. There's nothing exalted about being an effective executive. It's simply doing one's job like thousands of others. There's little danger that anyone will compare this essay on training oneself to be an effective executive with, say, Kierkegaard's great self-development tract, Training in Christianity. There are surely higher goals for a man's life than to become an effective executive, but only because the goal is so modest can we hope at all to achieve it. That is, to have the large number of effective executives modern society and its organizations need. If we required saints, poets, or even first-rate scholars to staff our knowledge positions, the large-scale organization would simply be absurd and impossible. The needs of large-scale organization have to be satisfied by common people achieving uncommon performance. This is what the effective executive has to make himself able to do. Though this goal is a modest one, one that everyone should be able to reach if he works at it, the self-development of an effective executive is true development of the person. It goes from mechanics to attitudes, values and character, from procedure to commitment. Self-development of the effective executive is central to the development of the organization, whether it be a business, a government agency, a research laboratory, a hospital, or a military service. It is the way toward performance of the organization. As executives work toward becoming effective, they raise the performance level of the whole organization. They raise the sights of people, their own as well as others. As a result, the organization not only becomes capable of doing better, it becomes capable of doing different things and of aspiring to different goals. Developing executive effectiveness challenges directions, goals, and purposes of the organization. It raises the eyes of its people from preoccupation.